It's Wednesday, September 10th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg returns to the media company he created. But the company didn't report on it at all. Why not? It's longstanding editorial policy not to cover itself. Smart decision or short-sighted? And after weeks of buildup, Chuck Todd takes over as moderator of Meet the Press. We'll talk about some of the changes to the show and its format, and even why Todd himself says he knows he's in for a challenge to bring it back. There's a lot more hopefully we'll get to as well, but let's start with the Baltimore Ravens' release of the NFL's indefinite suspension of Ray Rice. Monday, TMZ published surveillance video on its website that shows Rice beating his now wife, Janae Palmer, in an Atlantic City elevator. The incident happened last February. In late March, a grand jury indicted him on charges of aggravated assault. The next day, Rice and Palmer married. In May, Rice avoided formal prosecution after applying for a pretrial intervention program. If he completes that program, all the charges against him are said to be dismissed. Meanwhile, Rice continued all that time to practice with the Ravens. In June, Commissioner Roger Goodell met with Rice, and 5 weeks later, Goodell announced he'd suspended Rice from two games starting August 30th. On August 28th, after experiencing some extreme criticism for the NFL's leniency in domestic violence cases, the league announced that there would be more severe punishments going forward. And Monday, it all came to a head when TMZ ran that video. It was just a matter of hours from the time the video went up until the Baltimore Ravens waived Rice and the NFL issued that indefinite suspension, ostensibly ending Rice's pro football career. Some in the media still don't think that's enough. Here is ESPN's Keith Olbermann.
We begin tonight with the unavoidable and simple truth that intentionally or by neglect, the Atlantic County, New Jersey District Attorney's Office, the Baltimore Ravens, the National Football League, and Commissioner Roger Goodell have conducted a cover-up of Ray Rice's brutal assault on his then-fiancée on February 15th. There is no other conclusion possible. Each body, each leading individual involved, came to a judicial conclusion about what had happened to Janae Palmer and what should happen to Ray Rice, and each, through deception or incompetence, misled the public, damaged the efforts of every man and every woman in this country seeking to merely slow down the murderous epidemic of domestic violence, and made a mockery of the process by which those who batter those they claim to love are to be brought to justice. And not one of them, not Commissioner Goodell, not NFL Senior Vice President Adolfo Birch, not NFL Chief Counsel Jeff Pasch, not Baltimore Team President Richard Cass, not Baltimore General Manager Ozzie Newsome, not Assistant Prosecutor Diane Ruberton of Atlantic County, New Jersey, not Prosecutor Jim McClain, not Superior Court Judge Michael Doino, not Ray Rice himself. No matter what actions were taken today against Rice, nor what might be taken in the future, none of them have any remaining credibility, and each must leave or be expelled from their current positions. And despite the obsession of the moment, it does not truly matter whether they had seen this video before today. The league, the team, the prosecutors either whitewashed Ray Rice's brutal assault without ever having seen this video, or they saw the video and whitewashed Rice's brutal assault anyway.
Olbermann's commentary there goes on for about another 4 minutes. You can watch or listen to the entire thing on our links blog at kbia.org. Let's talk about the coverage of this story as we've seen it really unfold from February until now.
Well, one of the things that I want to do first is commend ESPN for the coverage that it's given to this. Usually in cases like this, especially involving the NFL, which I think is one of ESPN's top brands, they sort of back off on this, but on this one they were on top of it. They were forceful about what should happen before the NFL made its decision, before Baltimore made its decision. They've covered it from top to bottom. Now I also have to condemn them a little bit because they could have done some more reporting on this further back and pushed to get that video themselves. And in that regard, I would have to commend TMZ because they did go out and do that. So those are the first couple of things that I want to talk about in terms of the coverage. Other than that, they've done a pretty good job, as well as the rest of the media, in covering the issue of domestic violence and what it means to not only the victim, but also to the system as a whole. The other thing is that they're coming down pretty hard on Roger Goodell. And I think that that they should be commended for. But I also want they should understand that he works for the owners. And as long as he's doing certain things for the owners, they're going to want to keep him around.
I will agree that with ESPN's coverage has been better. I will even say with Olbermann, I mean, you know, this is one of his typical rants, even nothing if not bombastic. I remember from his MSNBC days, his indictments of President Bush and all this kind of stuff. But I can't disagree with any of the points that he made, basically, about who's culpable in all of this. And I think he didn't indict the media, which is one thing he might also have done and has done in the past. I do think that reporters were awfully quick to, you know, allow the NFL to try to craft the message the way they wanted to. And you know, I think the commissioner is nothing if not someone who's looking out for the brand. That's all he cares about when it comes to concussions or sexual assault. It's pretty obvious that those two issues are way down the ladder, and preserving the NFL's image is really a priority. I'd also say about TMZ, at some point, whether we like their methods or not, whether we like the fact that they pay for content and they brag about doing mm-hmm. that, they have become a legitimate news organization. And when it comes to covering sports, I mean, look what they've
just in the last year, the Donald Sterling story, that was truly broken by TMZ. The evidence in this story coming to light, coming from TMZ.
Yeah, but I think part of that goes to the fact that they aren't beholden to the leagues. Be it basketball, football, baseball, whatever, they aren't beholden to those leagues because in terms of contracts. And I think that's one of the things that sort of hinders, whether consciously or subconsciously, it hinders the way in which the mainstream news organizations and the sports organizations yeah. cover it, because they also have those contracts.
Perhaps from the broadcast perspective, yes, but there are plenty of traditional print legacy news organizations known for their investigative reporting. Now we're seeing some of that online. Are they beholden in that same way that an ABC or a CBS or an NBC might be?
I don't think that they're necessarily beholden, but they have a legacy of working very closely with them and having access. And that's where I think the problem comes in, is that if you cover it very extensively, if you're there on an everyday basis, you build these relationships, and those relationships are supposed to be sort of hands off, but in a lot of ways, because of the closeness, they're pretty tight. You don't see certain things, or you sort of gloss over certain things that you shouldn't be doing, especially when it comes to cases like this. I mean, the Baltimore beat writers who were covering the Ravens should have been on this thing top to bottom, and that didn't happen.
And they were in their reaction to this video. I mean, they did comprehensive reporting on it, but that's too much of what we're seeing these days, reacting to the news rather than, you know, being out there in front of the news. TMZ, by the way, just before we leave them, I'll say maybe this is one of those times when not knowing their corporate parentage gives them an advantage. They're owned by Time Warner, the same people that own CNN. And a lot of other traditional brands.
And HBO that has right. reality programming associated with.
But they're perceived as being this maverick entity that can go out there. And because they've been focused on Hollywood for the most part in the past, they get away with a lot of things. And I think they've actually served the public by having that brand, that image.
But I also have to commend the parent company for giving them the tools to do that. Letting them be hands off. Letting them be who they are, and not coming in and corporatizing them is probably the best way to put that.
One of the things that I guess is disturbing about this whole thing is the fact that it really did take the release of the second video, actually seeing the physical assault, not just the aftermath of it, that finally gets people to focus some attention on the story.
And interestingly enough, you know, Roger Goodell says he hadn't seen it, the owners hadn't seen it. But the real action didn't happen until we saw it, until the general public saw it, until it had been published. So that's kind of troublesome, too, that until it was really out there in the open, that there was reaction.
Well, one of the things people are saying, it's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to see it. Mm-hmm. And when people actually saw him hit her on video, that they were like, whoa, you know. Saying the word abuse is one thing, but seeing the actual abuse itself, that just opens up a whole new light on the situation.
Here's what surprises me, though. I don't know if the NFL, if Goodell or his legal counselor and those folks actually saw the video ahead of time or not.
They said they haven't.
We won't know. But they did see, and we all saw, the video of Rice dragging Janae Palmer out of the elevator.
Which should have been enough.
So they knew what happened. And so they surely had to believe that if TMZ and the casino and probably lawyers had access to him dragging her out, they probably had access to video within the elevator. If they wanted to know, they could have known it existed, and they certainly should have prepared for the fact that it would come out.
They knew that the videotape existed. They asked for the videotape and were not granted access to it. That's one of the things that they have admitted to. What I want to know is, okay, if you knew that the videotape existed, why didn't you go to Ray Rice and ask him, what's on that tape? What actually happened in the elevator? I want you to describe to me, as an NFL investigator who's going to make the decision on whether or not you get to
play again.
Because
a grand jury most likely saw it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What's on that tape? And those are the questions that if I was covering it, I would be asking Roger Goodell and the NFL investigators is, did you ask Ray Rice specifically what happened in that elevator? I want you to describe to me what happened.
I think there's an interesting ethical question that comes out of this whole thing. And we've seen the video. The video is what it took, I guess, to generate this kind of concentration on the issue. But on the other hand, the television media have been showing this video over and over again in a continuous loop. And, you know, Janae Palmer says, you're basically ruining my life. Some people are saying we are re-victimizing her by showing this video over and over. I think there's some truth to that. The question is, how do we balance that between her privacy and her welfare and the right of the public to talk about this issue and to call the NFL to account for it?
You know, I think we saw a little bit of that in the coverage in the days after 9/11, in the months and the years. And interestingly enough, discussing this on September 10th, we showed video of planes going into buildings. We did that for a couple of weeks. I would probably say, being in the newsroom, by the end of the month of September, we had a moratorium on that video to never use it or show it again. I think we're almost at a point where maybe we need to consider something similar as an industry to begin to wean off using this.
I agree. I think that's something that we're going to have to do. But and in doing that, we also need to talk about, these are things that happen on a daily basis to people who are not in the national spotlight. It's good that we're talking about it, but what more are we going to do? And that's where I think the media does have a responsibility to talk about domestic violence on a local level and really focus in on that and how they can help citizens to push this issue forward.
You know, we talk on a lot of these big stories that come up on our show lately about social media and what impact they had on. I think we ought to focus just a little bit on that, too. First of all, the fact that most people were aware of this video and this story probably came through social media. Mm-hmm. And secondly, if you want to talk about having a real positive impact for good, look at those hashtags that emerged, why I stayed or why I left. Just read a little bit of that and how it's been shared, and you can see how it's possible. I'm not saying it will happen, but it's possible this time, this case of domestic violence might actually make a difference in how we respond to it.
So on that topic, let's talk for a second about the forced chit-chat between anchors on morning TV and how awkward that can sometimes get. Listening to them talk about this incident on Fox and Friends here, we're about to listen to, it goes from painful to horribly inappropriate.
We should also point out, after that video, and now you know what happened in there, she still married him. They're currently married.
I mean, look, Rihanna went back to
Chris Brown
right after. A lot of people thought that was a terrible message.
And then there's Jay-Z and Beyonce and Solange. That was also in an elevator.
But he knows JV didn't hit back.
There was some craziness there.
I think the messages take the stairs.
The messages, when you're in an elevator, there's a camera.
As you can imagine, there was significant backlash after that aired. Yesterday, anchor Brian Kilmeade addressed that backlash, telling viewers, quote, comments that we made during the story yesterday made some feel like we were taking the situation too lightly. We are not. We were not. Domestic abuse is a very serious issue to us, I can assure you. Did I miss the apology in there?
I didn't see an apology in there.
No apology.
Yes, they were taking it lightly. They were trying to interject some humor into an issue that definitely did not deserve humor. Should not have. That just should not have happened. And for Fox, media and the Fox management, not to call them down on the carpet for that is inexcusable.
And I think they were trying to shoehorn in one of their typical talking points about personal responsibility into a lighthearted morning show format. And it was just bound to create that disaster.
Take the stairs. I mean, the first time I saw it, I couldn't believe it.
It's stupid.
And there are so many issues here. You were talking a little bit ago, Ernest, about domestic violence being a universal problem. Yet we hear them talking about Ray Rice and Janae Palmer, about Rihanna and Chris Brown, Jay-Z and Solange. In all of those cases, 6-7 African Americans. There are 3 Caucasians sitting on that set, in a way poking fun at relationship abuse in 3 African American examples. This is not a racial issue. And in a way, it's pointing it out, or at least I interpreted it as creating that.
Well, I think it's that. It's also the whole celebrity culture. They were sort of poking fun at that. I think it goes back to what Mike was talking about in terms of the personal responsibility angle. But here was an opportunity for them to actually talk about domestic violence in a way that would have helped spotlight the growing issue that needs to be addressed, that men should not be hitting women, women should not be, people shouldn't be hitting each other
at all
in these cases, and that we as a society need to address this. And instead of doing that, they tried to turn it into some morning talk show humor,
which was horribly, horribly inappropriate. Well, no one knows better than I do how hard it is to fill the chair of those we know, we love, and respect. A year ago, Mike and I shuffled chairs here, and I took over as producer and host of this program. Before that, Mike took the reins from one of his mentors and friends, Rod Gillette. Over the 18 years and 3 moderators of this program, you've seen and heard the show evolve and change. So I guess you could say I was able to relate in some ways when this came on my TV Sunday morning.
Welcome to Sunday. It's Meet the Press.
From NBC News in Washington, this is Meet the Press.
And good morning. Obviously, it's a pretty big honor for me to be sitting in this chair as the 12th moderator of the program, following in the footsteps of the likes of Martha Roundtree, Lawrence Spivak, Tim Russert, and of course, David Gregory. And as you can see, we're making a few changes around here. As I like to say, we're living in a house as we remodel it, so the program in this studio will continue to evolve over the coming months. But what better way to start off my first show than with an exclusive sit-down with the President of the United States?
Chuck Todd looked a bit jittery at the start of Sunday's program, but calmed as the hour progressed. That pressure is understandable, and as Todd told CNN's Brian Stelter, he thinks the public has a bit of a right to lay it on him. Thoughts on the show as you saw it on Sunday?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think the fact that Chuck Todd does not look like the well-coiffed, tanned TV anchor host that we sometimes see was playing well for him. And almost every media critic who looked at his first show was giving him the benefit of the doubt, was talking about the deep respect he has in Washington, the deep knowledge he has of the subject, the fact that he doesn't look like a TV host, even, you know, basically giving him credit for trying to get some answers out of President Obama when, as we've said before, one of the biggest problems for Sunday shows is that politicians now know how to avoid the kinds of questions, the tough ones that people used to ask, like Tim Russert and maybe like, we hope, Chuck Todd.
And he's been very upfront about the idea of the show being a work in progress, including new segments that they're testing out. Some of the titles of those, Who Needs Washington, What Everyone in Washington Knows But Is Afraid to Say. Panelists who were on there were, I think, 7 guests that he had on there as analysts. Not the stodgy talking heads you were used to from seeing on Meet the Press going back decades. In fact, one of them from BuzzFeed had his sleeves rolled up and there was a whole lot of ink showing. Is this the Sunday talk show for the next generation?
Well, I think it's going to have to be because the generation that had been watching it beforehand, they're passing on. And they also have other things that they're having to compete against. I mean, three letters come to mind, NFL. Mm-hmm. So for Chuck Todd to be starting as the new host of Meet the Press on the Sunday that the NFL cranks up for 2014.
It's definitely some counter-programming.
That's some serious counter-programming there. So he's going to be running up against some serious competition.
I like the fact that he had on a couple of younger panelists. He also had on Andrea Mitchell. You know, I like the fact that he went out and had a segment, take us outside the Beltway, you know, interviewing, you know, people from communities, politicians outside of Washington. But, you know, he also had on President Obama. And frankly, I'm not sure he can have it both ways, although NBC would like to have it. The gravitas and attracting all those traditional viewers back to their show instead of to the other competitors. But I don't know that you can do that and have edge. It's hard to imagine how you do both of those at the same time.
And I think part of it is just the segmentation of television news now. And now the Sunday morning talk shows themselves are having to deal with that. So I think he's trying to bring something new to the table. And what's going to happen is that you're going to have a certain segment of the audience that goes toward that. And then you're going to have a certain segment that's going to go with Bob Schieffer and a certain segment that's going to go with ABC, whoever they're permanent anchor mm-hmm. is going to be, because they seem to switch people on in the chair often as
pretty
well.
Pretty regularly. Mm-hmm.
If anybody can do it, you know, at least can bring back the traditional viewers who want to know about the Washington power structure and all that, it should be Chuck Todd. If he can't do it, nobody can.
Okay, well, this weekend, journalists flocked to Nashville for the Excellence in Journalism Conference. The annual event is a collaboration between the Society of Professional Journalists and the Radio Television Digital News Association. One of the panels at the event focused on the coverage of last month's events in Ferguson. Journalists who spent time there talked about their experience. Strangely, none of the panelists there were from any of the St. Louis publications. Now, RTNDA now stands for Radio Television Digital News Association, but it used to be the Radio Television News Directors Association. Kind of hard to believe that their membership base couldn't come up with anybody from St. Louis, no?
Well, I find it hard to believe. I mean, one of the reasons they gave was because they put this panel on at the last minute, and that there was some travel restrictions that were there that kept some people from being there.
Logistics from St. Louis to Nashville.
Exactly. But I think that, you know, in today's world, you're talking about digital. They could have put Skype somebody in.
Mm-hmm.
They could have, you know,
for free.
You know, they could have done something. So to have this kind of a panel, but not have someone there who was in charge of coverage or someone who was there covering it, I just found it unbelievable.
They also made the justification early on that, well, we had people from St. Louis who were there, not working for St. Louis media, including our very own J School alum Elise Hu from NPR. Yes, okay, that's fine. They were there. But we need to have someone talking about how the local media covered it, what the local media learned, what the local media need to do going forward with this story, as I'm sure you're going to share with our audience. Another group learned from their mistake.
Another group did learn from their mistake. The Online News Association, a group that I should disclose I'm a member of, and I will be attending their conference at the end of the month, kind of saw the heat that RTDNA and SPJ took for this, and also having a keynote address at that conference on what journalists learned from Ferguson. And ONA has posted something on its website that it is currently looking to rework that panel, invite new guests to bring them in, and make sure there is some kind of a St. Louis presence as a part of that.
Well, I think part of the problem here is, I mean, think about the name of it. What did journalists learn from Ferguson?
Mm-hmm.
Journalists are still learning from Ferguson.
It's true.
I think mm-hmm. the best thing for them to have done would have been to sort of back off from it and come back at it again next year when you have time to actually look at what was the coverage like, what was the aftermath of the coverage, where are we today? I mean, to try to pull all that together less than a month after it happened.
It's our
and
instant
then say,
gratification
yeah,
society
exactly.
right there, though. Got to do it right now.
But that's what gets you into trouble, because you really can't talk about what you learned because you're still
you
in
haven't
the
had a chance to
yeah.
learn it.
Well,
I mean,
we can do it right now and do it after some reflection. And if we are going to do it right now, first of all, they're trying to attract media people to come to the conference. And so to talk about things that are in the news right now is useful, but they certainly need to focus on local news. I mean, we have lots of issues involving what's happening with the national media, but if there's an endangered source of news in this country, it's local news, and we need to make sure that we're always thinking about how they respond to and what their role is in covering these things.
Okay, so here's one that I want to throw at you. Michael Bloomberg, this year he was term limited out as mayor of New York City. So he returned to Bloomberg LP, the media company he founded. Only it was the New York Times that broke the story, much to the chagrin of many of Bloomberg's business reporters. That's because of a long-standing company policy not to cover the company itself. One of my old bosses, Anne-Marie Lipinski, who's now at Harvard, has said that to shy away from covering your own ownership is bad policy. Agree?
I would agree, especially in today's media world where you have media companies that are either owned by a bunch of other companies or own a bunch of other companies. You're going to have to cover yourself at some point. So I think that, you know, in this particular case, they should rescind that policy.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can defend it, but it's kind of quaint at the very least. I mean, they're transparent about it. They acknowledge it. They're not hiding anything most of the time by not reporting on themselves. But there is a problem when you carry it to the extent that they do of not even showing what other people are writing about them. And that can be important when you're the source of a controversy. The story last year, for example, about what happened with their reporting in China and whether they self-censored to try to keep their business there. You've got to have exceptions at the very least to that kind of rule when it comes to you being in the news in that manner.
Okay. I want to talk about something at the Huffington Post. It's hired another reporting fellow that is somewhat, shall we say, unconventional. Dante Stallworth will be covering national security based in Washington. Since 2002, he's been a wide receiver in the NFL, currently an unsigned free agent. He's also what some would call a 9/11 truther. Here's an example of what I mean by that. In 2009, he tweeted there was, quote, no way 9/11 was carried out by dying bin Laden, 19 men who couldn't fly a damn kite. Still, no evidence Osama was connected like a rock. His Twitter feed reportedly looked and sounded a bit like that through last year. But after his HuffPost hiring, it suddenly took a more mainstream tone, tweeting, quote, just to be clear, I no longer feel the way I did in that tweet 5 years ago. Why Dante Stallworth?
Why? That's I have
national
no idea.
Security.
Yeah, you have so many other people that you could give a second chance to. Why him? I just don't understand why I decided to do this.
I'm okay generally with the notion of giving people second chances, which is kind of the laughable defense that HuffPo had. But somebody who really doesn't even think that it's important to have facts behind your conclusions.
I mean, as I like to say, we deal in facts here at the Missouri School of Journalism.
And he's covering national security. I mean, that's a pretty important issue, regardless of whether you're the Huffington Post or you're running a blog out there on your own. I mean, they shouldn't do this. It makes no sense to me.
How long do you think it'll last?
It might be over by the end of the week.
Very well could be.
No, in all seriousness, do you think the Huffington Post is going to give him a chance to keep going with this? Or do you think it's something that they really do pull the plug on just based on pressure?
I have no idea.
They should pull the plug.
Well, thanks for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today. Check out our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. They're all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, and see what we'll be talking about next week. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Hope Kerwin and Josie Herrera are our associate producers. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.